The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. Good evening. So tonight I'd like to begin with a little excerpt from the suttas, from the discourses. And some of you might know that there's the Pali Canon that is preserved in Pali, that's the Theravada tradition. And there's also a parallel versions of this, not complete, but they were written in Sanskrit and preserved in Chinese. We lost the Sanskrit originals, but we have the Chinese little bits and pieces. So sometimes it's interesting to look at what was in the Pali Canon and then look at the corresponding sutta in what's called the Agamas that are preserved and compare them and see how they're different and how they're the same. They're all a little bit different to get an idea of maybe what were some later accretions or what were some of the earlier versions. And I'm only saying that because I like to tell a story that's in the suttas, but I'm starting with kind of what's in the Nikayas, and I'm borrowing this little bit that comes from the Agamas that's found in the Chinese version, and I'm bringing it over and making it into one sutta. So in this sutta, there's a lay person who goes up to the Buddha. Maybe I'll just start here and say, at this time, several monastics were making a robe for the Buddha, thinking that when his robe was finished and the 3 months of the rains retreat had passed, the Buddha would set out wandering. It was the tradition that during the monsoon season, the monastics wouldn't travel. They would stay in one place. And that tradition even goes on today, where to have three-month retreats. I know IMS, Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, they've been holding three-month retreats, I think 40-some-odd years. I think last year was the, or 2020 was the only time in which it hadn't occurred, if I understand correctly. So this idea of staying in place for 3 months at a time. So it was nearing the end of the 3 months, and it was common for the Buddha then to go wander and to teach. And it was also common for people to make new robes for him and to give that as an offering at the end of the rains retreat. So Mahanama, the Sakyan, heard about this. So he's a lay person, he's not a monastic. And he went up to the Buddha and said to him, "Blessed one, I am no longer in control of my four limbs. I am losing the sense of the four directions, and I am forgetting the teachings I have learned. As I heard from a group of many monastics who had assembled to sew the Blessed One's robes, that soon the Blessed One, with the rainy season retreat being completed and his robes having been made, will take his robes and bowl and journey among the people." So Mahanama is saying he's just overcome with, I don't know what it is exactly, but he feels like he just lost control of his limbs and he has lost sense of the directions and forgetting the teachings. To think that this teacher, who was so important for him, we can imagine, is leaving. And probably Mahanama, right, wasn't able to follow him and wasn't a monastic and wasn't going to follow him. But we can feel this urgency, like, oh no. This person who was really supported me so much were the teachings and the monastics, they're leaving. I won't have access to them. Remembering, of course, thousands of years ago, of course, there aren't books that have the teachings written down. There aren't audio recordings, video recordings, you know, all these types of things. Like when a person left, you didn't really have access to their teachings any longer. So Mahanama continues and he says to the Buddha, "For this reason, I'm now reflecting, when will I get to see the Blessed One again? And the monastics with whom I'm acquainted." So some of the Buddha's followers were really meaningful to Mahanama as well. And the Buddha replies, "Whether you see the Blessed One," probably you figured out that's the Buddha, right? "Whether you see the Blessed One or you do not see the Blessed One, whether you see the monastics with whom you are acquainted or you do not see them, you should be mindful of five qualities and make an effort to cultivate them. Mahanama, the faithful succeed, not the faithless. The energetic succeed, not the lazy. The mindful succeed, not the unmindful. Those with concentration succeed, not those without concentration. The wise succeed, not the witless." So the Buddha is saying, even though I'm not here, or my followers, or people who can give you the teachings, you can cultivate these five qualities. You might recognize this list as the five faculties. So even though the Buddha isn't there to kind of like maybe guide the way, he's saying just cultivate these qualities instead of having the Buddha there, the next best thing maybe. So for me, I find this rather inspiring, where the Buddha, he recognizes, you know, that poor Mahanama is distraught, and he's telling him the faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, cultivate these and you will succeed. It's interesting that he uses this word succeed, right? Mahanama isn't a monastic. He's pointing to him, you will be successful in your spiritual life, in your professional life. Of course, he's not using these exact words, but you know, this is how to have be able to bring things to fruition and to have things go the way that you wish for them to go. Not in a way that we're muscling our way into and forcing them to happen, but in a way in which we create the conditions in which they can unfold. So I've given a few talks on the faculties, and so this is actually the fourth one. I'll just say briefly that the first two talks were about just cultivating and developing the faculties as a whole. The third one was about balancing some of the faculties, and specifically balancing energy and concentration. And tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about balancing faith and wisdom. And this is partly comes out of this simile where there's a charioteer who's driving a chariot, and there's four horses. And the charioteer represents mindfulness, the one who is giving the directions and saying where to go and what speed and these types of things. And then two horses next to one another are energy and concentration, and then the other two horses next to them are faith and wisdom. So they all have to be in balance, and they all have to kind of like be in in accordance and aware of each other and this. So this idea of balancing faith and wisdom, when we hear this word faith, we might think that it's about just believing the right things. But of course, if you've been around the Dharma scene for a while, you know that faith in the Buddhist practice is not about that at all. Instead, it's about where we only have limited experience, but there's something inside us, maybe it's like a guitar string that has been strummed, and it vibrates, and there's a sound, or somehow like a certain resonance. Faith is like recognizing something that we've heard or experienced touches us and speaks to us. Maybe not literally, but, you know, something resonates in it. It might be very subtle, but it's a call to, yeah, this is worth investigating some more. This is worth exploring. This is worth putting some effort towards, some energy towards. And so maybe it's like the call to learn something new. Maybe we have this idea, maybe in the COVID era, we want to learn something new. Spend our time doing something that's enriching, and rather than doom scrolling or, you know, to be baking or I don't know, whatever it might be. Maybe it's something bigger. Maybe there's a call similar to the call to start a family or to change one's job or career or something like this. So all of us have these, maybe they're kind of like these intuitions or this idea like, yes, this feels wholesome and it feels like this is a direction to go. So, of course, it's not the end of the journey. It's just the beginning of the journey. I'll say for me that I had this experience the very first time I ever heard a Buddhist Dharma talk was in a yoga class. It was a weekend workshop. And I really had no idea what it was going to be. But I like to do yoga, so I signed up at my favorite yoga studio for this weekend workshop. This is now quite some years ago. And after we did some asana practice, you know, moving the body into these different postures, then there was a break, and then we came back, and we were in the yoga studio, and we were all sitting in our on our mats, and in walked this person wearing these red and gold clothes, which now I know are what for Tibetan teachers wear. But at that time I didn't know that. And he had this really, really distinct accent from Minnesota, North Dakota, you know, that type of an accent. And so for me, I was trying to like a little confused, like what is he wearing and why is he and speaking this way with what he's wearing, I couldn't quite understand. And he started talking about the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma. And I don't know if my jaw dropped, but there was just something that just felt so beautiful to me and struck my heart in some kind of way. So maybe you have a story like this too, and maybe not. Maybe you've just dipping your toe in, and I don't know, I'm not quite sure. So whether it's a really strong sense of, yes, this is something that feels like I really want to do this, there's something inside of me that is saying this, or maybe it's just a little bit of curiosity. In some ways, this is faith. We don't know yet, right? We don't have direct experience. We don't have knowledge. But we believe that this is something that's worth pursuing. And one way that faith is described is in the suttas, as a simile for a citadel, for like a fortress or something at the end of the countryside. And this little quote goes, "Just as a king's frontier citadel has a pillar with deep foundations, firmly embedded, imperturbable and unshakable, to defend those within and repel those outside, in the same way, a noble disciple has faith in the awakening of the realized one, the blessed one." So maybe your faith doesn't feel like it's a pillar that's with deep foundations and firmly embedded, or maybe it does. And maybe you can tap into that and allow it to support you. And here it's talking about faith in the awakening of the realized one, or the blessed one. That is, this faith, this belief that indeed there was a person who had enlightenment, and that awakening is possible, that human beings have this capacity. So that's how we can talk about faith. And so when faith at its best, it produces this enthusiasm, or kind of like galvanizes energy for practice. And it can serve as a real support in times of difficulties, because all of us have difficulties in our meditation practice or our Buddhist practice or any spiritual practice, right? All of them. There's times when there's difficulties. This is what it feels like, right? To be stretched a little bit and to be challenged a little bit. And this is what spiritual practices do, right? So it can help allow us to move forward, and faith can help us to not hold back, or maybe hold back less. And it also could help us to appreciate that some truly brilliant, dedicated, and wise people have come before us on this path. And they have left methods and maps for us. And we can follow these methods and these maps, and we can achieve what they have achieved. And now it might be something that is a support for us. So faith can be a real support. If we don't have any faith, it can lead to some giving up as soon as things get difficult, or some cynicism, thinking that that everybody's just in it for the money or for the glory, or I don't know, to impress their neighbors or something like this. Or maybe if without faith we just kind of have this half-hearted effort, or maybe a sense of bitterness. I've been doing all this work and I didn't get what I wanted, I expected it, or something like this. But if we have too much faith, there can be this, we might start to get dogmatic. Like, no, this is the way it is, this is the truth, and everything else is wrong. That's not helpful. I might start to be some sectarian arrogance. The way that I practice Buddhism is the only true Buddhism, the real Buddhism, and I don't know what the rest of you guys are doing, but this is the true one. That's not helpful for anybody. It might, excess faith might lead to some blind adherence without having it touch our hearts, or without really engaging our minds, and just doing exactly what was expected of us or being told with us. And maybe importantly, if we have like excess faith and have this idea that if you just believe enough, that will be sufficient, it leads to an inability to realistically examine and our approach to our spiritual life. Like, is the way that we're doing this, is this supportive? Is it onward leading? Is it helpful for not only us, but for others around us? So in order to counteract some of these, it can be faith can be balanced with wisdom. And so when there is this, and I'll talk about wisdom in just a moment here, but faith, when it's balanced with wisdom, has a different feeling. It has this a quality of the surreal inquiry of, is this helpful? Is this helpful? Is this skillful? Is this wholesome? Is this the way forward? And also, faith and wisdom, faith when it's balanced with wisdom, it has this sense of humility. Not an arrogance that I'm going to muscle my way through, or I know better than, or my group knows better. It also has a steadiness, so maybe with some warm-heartedness with it, some steadiness. So what is wisdom? So wisdom, of course, is a faculty we all have, numbers of ways that we can define it, but one is that it allows us to discern and distinguish and discriminate between what is helpful and what isn't helpful. Helps us to find our way and to understand and to see things more clearly, to put them in a way, not only to see things, but to incorporate them into our understanding and allow our understanding to shift and change as we see more and as we learn more, have more experiences, hear more teachings. So wisdom is not the same as knowledge. They're related, of course, but knowledge is just the accumulation of knowing more and more. And maybe I'll quote a little bit from yet one more sutta where this time it's a priest from the dominant religious tradition at the time of the Buddha, comes up to him and says, and describes wisdom, a wise person, and then the Buddha counters him. So the person's name is Vasakara, and Vasakara goes up to the Buddha and says, Master Gotama, because he's a priest, he addresses the Buddha, a priest of another tradition. He doesn't call him the Blessed One, he calls him Master Gotama. Master Gotama, when someone has four qualities, we describe them as a great person with great wisdom. So here are the four qualities. They are very learned in diverse fields of learning. They understand the meaning of diverse statements. They have a good memory, and they are deft and tireless in household duties. And they understand how to go about things in order to complete and organize the work. So this is what Vasakara is saying is a wise person. And then he says, if Master Gotama agrees with me, please say so. And if he disagrees, please say so. And the Buddha responds by saying, I neither agree nor disagree. But here are four other qualities that are for a wise person. So the Buddha isn't saying that to be learned and have a good memory and understand things isn't part of wisdom. But he would describe it a different way. And he has these other four qualities. They practice for the welfare and happiness of the many. That's one. They think what they want to think and don't think what they don't want to think. So they have some capacity with their mental capabilities. They aren't being pushed around by whatever their thoughts are coming up. That's the second. The third one is they attain the four jhanas. So these are concentration states. These are states when the mind gets settled. He describes them as blissful meditations in the present life that belong to the higher mind. So they're able to direct their mind and settle the mind in a particular way. And the fourth reason is a wise person realizes the undefiled freedom of heart and freedom by wisdom in this very life. So it's not so much about the contents of the mind that the Buddha is saying is a wise person, but their capacity to use the mind in particular ways, and the practice for the welfare and happiness of the many. I don't know, I find this inspiring that so much, is what we do as part of meditation practice is to train the mind. And this is what the Buddha is saying is what is wisdom. And of course, wisdom is a way to awakening. Buddhism is called a wisdom tradition for this reason. But if we have this idea of too much wisdom, which I would say maybe is we wouldn't call wisdom. If there's too much, maybe there's too much knowledge or not enough wisdom, but in the Visuddhimagga, which is a commentary that's hundreds of years after the Pali Canon, too much wisdom is defined as one strong in wisdom and weak in faith, so out of balance here, errs on the side of the cunning and is as hard to cure as sickness caused by medicine. So cunning, you know, that is like trying to find the loopholes or trying to show skill by achieving, showing one's skills using like deceit or evasion or, you know, finding the little loopholes of things rather than some real wisdom, which has some wholesomeness to it, and is as hard to cure as a sickness caused by medicine. Right? Because knowledge is helpful, but it's more having to be balanced with faith. Maybe we could think about this, the head and the heart being in balance. If faith is a heartfeltness, is the string being strung, and the heart, the mind being able to have these capacities, but not in a way that is ends up being devious or finding all the loopholes. So if we don't have enough wisdom, there might be a way in which we have this emphasis on just acquiring knowledge. Okay, I just got to learn more. I have to read more suttas, listen to more Dharma talks. I just have to acquire more and more and more. And it's easy to fall into that trap, partly because, you know, our society values education, right? You have to learn, you have to do well in school. And certainly there's so many media empires that spend untold amount of money to convince you that you need to know more, right? What you need to know now, right? They're always trying to send this message. But wisdom at its best comes from this deep and direct investigation of our experience. And that gets coupled with earlier experiences we've had and gets combined with teachings that we've had. But it's a way that uses the mind and this beautiful capacities that minds have as a support for more and more freedom, for more and more ease, more and more peace, and not just for ourselves, but for all beings, for all beings. So that we might use these beautiful minds, these beautiful hearts that we have as a support for everyone, without exception. Thank you.